The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
There's a story that goes back at least 2,000 years. It's the parable of the Chinese farmer, which comes from Taoism. Here's Alan Watts telling this story.
Once upon a time, there was a Chinese farmer who lost a horse, ran away. And all the neighbors came round that evening and said, "That's too bad." And he said, "Maybe." The next day, the horse came back and brought 7 wild horses with it. And all the neighbors came around and said, "Why, that's great, isn't it?" And he said, "Maybe." The next day, his son was attempting to tame one of these horses and was riding it and was thrown and broke his leg. And all the neighbors came around in the evening and said, "Well, that's too bad, isn't it?" And the farmer said, "Maybe." And the next day, the conscription officers came around looking for people for the army, and they rejected his son because he had a broken leg. And all the neighbors came around that evening and said, "Isn't that wonderful?" And he said, "Maybe."
The meaning of the parable is never to get too high after a perceived victory or too low after a perceived loss, because...
because you never know what will be the consequences of a misfortune. Or you never know what will be the consequences of good fortune.
This parable seems especially applicable to those who claim to be wrongfully convicted. Like Adnan Syed, they might be awarded a new trial, only to have that ruling reversed in appeal. Or like Terrence Lewis, they might give up on that appeal so they can be resentenced, only to have the judge surprisingly find them actually innocent. And they might learn years after their conviction that a DNA profile has been recovered from the murder weapon. A review of Innocence Project's cases over a 5-year period found that post-conviction DNA testing was essentially a coin flip. In 43% of cases, such testing proved innocence. In 42% of cases, DNA testing confirmed guilt. And in 15% of cases, the testing was inconclusive. In January 2018, DNA testing was done in the cinder block that was used to kill Leroy Owens. Would that testing prove Joseph Webster's innocence, confirm his guilt, or leave him in legal limbo?
Welcome to Undisclosed. This episode is Maybe, the third and final episode in our Undisclosed series, The State vs. Joseph Webster, about a Nashville man in prison for the 1998 murder of Leroy Owens. My name is Robbie Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author of the New York Times bestseller, Adnan's Story. And as always, I'm joined by my co-hosts, Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
Hi, I'm Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at The View from LL2.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
Before getting to that DNA testing, let's track Joseph Webster's appeals over the years. As we noted in episode 1, while Leroy Owens was killed in 1998, Joseph Webster wasn't arrested for that murder until 2005, and his trial wasn't held until 2006, despite no evidence collected after 1998 actually being presented at the trial. At this point, if you're familiar with the Bill of Rights, you might be wondering about the right to a speedy trial enshrined in the Sixth Amendment. The most famous Supreme Court case on this right is Barker versus Wingo, in which the Supreme Court had to consider whether to apply something known as the demand rule. Under this rule, the clock on the right to a speedy trial didn't start ticking until the defendant demanded a trial.
Your Honor, in the present case, it is contended that the demand rule as such chills his right to a speedy trial. We had a man here who was indicted for willful murder. Now, his accomplice had twice received the death penalty. This put him in the position of, if he has to demand trial to protect his right to a speedy trial, he is possibly asking the prosecution to give him the electric chair. The result, if he is successful, is death. This is a grisly choice, which this court condemned in Fay versus Noy.
You're saying that he can't be required to come in and ask for what he will later contend he should have been given automatically. I don't see that there's any chilling or burden there when you're dealing exactly with the thing that you're requesting.
But the court ultimately did find a chilling effect to the demand rule and instead decided to assess whether there was a violation of the right to a speedy trial by looking not only at whether the defendant made a demand for a speedy trial, but also the length of the delay, the reason for the delay, and the prejudice caused by the delay. Applying the standard, the Supreme Court found that a 5-year delay between arrest and trial was extraordinary, but did not prejudice the defendant and found no constitutional violation. Of course, there was a 7-year delay in Joseph Webster's case between the crime and the trial, but there was no arrest in 1998. So where does that leave Webster? It leaves him out of luck under the right to a speedy trial, which usually requires an arrest to start the clock ticking. But many courts, including the Supreme Court of Tennessee, have found that an unreasonable delay between the crime and the defendant's arrest can violate the right to due process. In the case of Harold Gray, the Supreme Court of Tennessee found that essentially the same test applies to these claims as claims that there was a violation of the right to a speedy trial. We look at the length of the delay, the reason for the delay, and the prejudice to the defendant. And in Harold Gray's case, where the delay was 42 years, the case has to be dismissed.
Joseph Webster's trial counsel made similar arguments before his trial. There was a delay of 7 years, and the state gave no explanation for that delay. This seems to be a pretty compelling argument, but trial counsel failed to explain how Joseph Webster had been prejudiced from this delay. And this was a pretty shocking omission, given how easy it would have been to show that several forms of prejudice had happened. Like with Dennis Perry, the passage of time between the crime and the arrest would make it really difficult to establish an alibi. And if Joseph was arrested back in 1998, it would have been fairly easy for him to establish that he didn't own a station wagon. This task became much harder, however, 7 years later on. And so, while there was a solid argument that the charges against Joseph should have been dropped, the trial proceeded, and he was convicted. After he was convicted, Joseph filed a direct appeal, and as we noted in episode 1, the basis for this claim was that his brother, Kenny Neal, had confessed to the crime to 3 different people, including their mother, Marie Burns.
And Kenny actually admitted that he committed the crime to you?
Yes. He told me that gangster and Joseph was him, but they did.
Burns would testify that not only had Kenny confessed to the murder, but also that Kenny owned a white station wagon at the time of the murder.
Do you remember Kenny having a white station wagon back in 1998?
Yes, he did. Yes, he did.
Do you remember anything about that station wagon?
Yeah, it was Kenny's station wagon, and Joseph don't drive Kenny's stuff, and Kenny don't drive Joseph's stuff.
Joseph's wife, Katrina, and his brother, Arthur Gordon, also testified that Kenny had confessed to them. And Kenny was also called as a witness. As the court held in its opinion, he denied that he owned a white station wagon in 1998. He admitted that his mother questioned him about the murder, but claimed that he walked out of the door instead of talking to her about the murder. When asked why he did not specifically deny committing the murder, Mr. Neal responded, quote, "I didn't have a reason to say anything about it." The Court of Criminal Appeals of Tennessee ultimately denied Joseph relief, not because it found Kenny Neal credible or that the other witnesses were not credible, but based on timing. According to the court, quote, the evidence was available prior to petitioner's trial, and petitioner has failed to show that he used reasonable diligence in seeking the newly discovered evidence. Marie Burns would probably agree with this reasoning, but not the result.
The lawyer we had, he gonna say, nah, I believe, yeah, Mr. Webster didn't do the crime. You knew that from the jump, because we kept telling you he didn't do it. And he kept telling you to put his mom on stand, and you said no. And I asked you, and you said no.
Why do you think he didn't put you on the stand?
Because for one time, when they asked me to test the tape to come to my house, and what did he say and stuff, they didn't want me to say that out in court.
Kids face a million online distractions. Fortnite, Snapchat, Instagram, TikTok, YouTube. The list goes on and on. Circle makes it easy to take childhood offline when needed, so they can focus on homework, chores, or bedtime. Circle is the easiest way to manage your family's online time across all their connected devices, both inside and outside your home. With Circle Home Plus and the Circle app, parents can filter what content is allowed, set limits for screen time, and monitor both history and usage. You can keep track across every connected device, from laptops, phones, and tablets, to smart TVs, streaming devices, and video game consoles, all from one app. Each family member has a profile that's fully customizable for their needs, age, and maturity. You'll never stop worrying about your kids, but with Circle, you'll have one less thing to worry about. And right now, our listeners can get a limited time offer of $30 off of a Circle Home Plus when you visit meetcircle.com/undisclosed and enter undisclosed at checkout. Again, you can get $30 off when you visit meetcircle.com/undisclosed and enter undisclosed at checkout. This is a limited time podcast exclusive offer. Again, that's meetcircle.com/undisclosed and enter undisclosed to save $30. Subsequently, in 2009, Joseph Webster brought a petition for post-conviction relief, alleging several grounds for a new trial. One was that trial counsel failed him based upon failing to argue that he was prejudiced based upon the 7-year delay between crime and trial. At the hearing in the petition, trial counsel claimed he didn't remember the specifics of the motion because it had been argued by co-counsel, although he guessed that there was insufficient evidence of prejudice to grant relief. This was good enough for the court. A second ground for relief claimed by Joseph was that trial counsel failed in his cross-examination of Tammy Nelson regarding inconsistent statements and his gold teeth. As we noted last episode, there were many inconsistencies in Tammy Nelson's police statements, including not mentioning that the perpetrators gave her a pager number to contact them until her third police statement. While trial counsel touched upon these, he didn't explore them in depth. The Court of Criminal Appeals of Tennessee rejected this argument, concluding that
trial counsel did not recall specific things about which he cross-examined Ms. Nelson at trial, but explained that he did not feel like he was getting anywhere because she was such a good witness, and his strategy was to back off.
But what about the gold teeth? I recently talked with Joseph about his initial decision to get those gold teeth and how noticeable they are.
Well, it was at the time, like when I was younger growing up, 18, 17, 18, 19, That was a lot of my peers. That's what they was getting at the time. Gold teeth, and I always wanted gold teeth.
Right, and the reason you want gold teeth is you want people to see the gold teeth, right?
Exactly.
And how often do people comment about your gold teeth?
I mean, if I speak to you or talk to you, it's very obvious that you can tell I can't have them. It's 12 of them.
Surprisingly, the Court of Criminal Appeals of Tennessee didn't directly address this issue in its opinion. Now, I guess you could say that the court did address the failure to question Tammy Nelson about the gold teeth when it affirmed trial counsel's decision to back off of Nelson because she was coming off as a good witness. But that explanation wouldn't seem to make sense. It seems defensible for an attorney to claim that he stopped picking at inconsistencies in a witness's prior statements because she was coming off as a good witness. But there were no inconsistencies regarding the gold teeth. Tammy Nelson didn't mention them in her first police statement, her second police statement, or her third police statement. All that trial counsel had to do was ask Tammy Nelson whether she ever mentioned the perpetrator had gold teeth, and then have Joseph Webster display his full mouth of gold teeth to the jury. But he didn't, and the court never explained why this should not be grounds for a new trial. Of course, this wasn't the only issue related to Tammy Nelson in the petition for post-conviction relief. As we noted in episode 1, there's the fact that Nelson recanted her identification as Joseph Webster on several occasions post-trial, and even named his brother Kenny Neal as the perpetrator. Colin recently talked to Marie Burns about how all this came about.
Now, Tammy Nelson came and talked to you after trial, right?
Yes, she did. She asked my son, the one that got killed. She asked him, she said, "Will you please take me to your mama, call your mama. She said, I know your mama don't want me around her, but I got to tell the truth. I got to tell the truth to her." And my son called me. He said, "Mama, Tammy wants to talk to you." I said, "Don't bring her to my house." He said, "Mama, listen to what she have to say." And I said, "Well, okay then." So he brought her, and she came to the kitchen. In the kitchen, she was crying. She said, "Miss Marie, I'm sorry for what I did." She said, "But Joseph wasn't the one. It was your other son." And she said, "I want to be honest with you, and I want to go back to court about it." And we did affidavits and all of this and went back to court.
This takes us back to the parable of the Chinese farmer. Marie Burns didn't want to hear from the woman who sent her son to prison, thinking it would only rub salt in the wound. But Nelson ended up delivering news that might lead any reasonable mother to believe that her son would soon be set free. But then, as in so many similar cases, what seems to be good news turns out to be bad news.
And the judge told her that her word was no good. Okay, it was good when she first testified and said that he was the one. It was good then. Why was she just coming back and tell the truth? Y'all don't want to believe her. Then nobody tell her to come back, looking for me and tell the truth about the situation.
And so, finding that Tammy Nelson's recantations were unreliable, Joseph Webster was again denied a new trial, with little reason to believe that he would ever be given relief. Then in December of 2016, another door opened. That year, Davidson County, which covers Nashville, decided to create a Conviction Review Unit, or CRU. Here's a News Channel 5 piece on that CRU.
The District Attorney's Office Conviction Review Unit is designed to make sure no one person is in prison wrongfully convicted. News Channel 5's Kelsey Gibbs takes us through this process.
If somebody's in prison, they don't need to do a day in prison if they're innocent.
The National Registry of Wrongful Convictions show that the state of Tennessee has exonerated just over 25 inmates since 1989. That's a loss of more than 230 years.
The court system is designed to address it to a certain extent where mistakes are made, but sometimes when there's a claim of innocence, we need to go a step further.
Assistant District Attorney Robert Jones is leading a unit at the Nashville DA's office to review convictions. Out of 3,000 district attorney offices nationwide, there's just about 35 conviction review units. Jones says the units aren't designed to second-guess a jury's decision or a court, but instead to be an extra set of eyes when new evidence is presented.
We need to be able to look at old cases, especially where someone is claiming that they were wrongfully convicted.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it. Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at Remarkable.com today.
Craftsman Days are here at Lowe's with big savings on the tools you need. Save $100 on the Craftsman V26 Tool Power Tool Combo Kit, now at $199. No matter what the project is, Craftsman's high-quality, high-performance products empower you to build on. Visit Lowe's and check out the full line of Craftsman tools today. Valid through 7/9 while supplies last. Selection varies by location. Maximum initial battery voltage measured without a workload is 20 volts. Nominal voltage is 18.
We all know that owning a small business means you wear many hats, but sometimes you really need an extra pair of hands. Upwork is how good companies find great and trusted freelance talent. With more than 2 decades of experience with a simple and ambitious goal of pioneering a better way of working, companies at every stage turn to Upwork to get things done and find more flexibility in staffing key projects and initiatives. They access a global marketplace filled with top talent in IT, web dev, marketing, and more. Posting a job on Upwork is easy. With no cost to join, you can register, browse freelance profiles, get help drafting a job post, or even book a consultation. From there, you connect with freelancers that get you and can easily hire them to take your business to the next level. Visit Upwork.com today and post your job for free. That's Upwork.com to post your job for free and connect with top talent ready to help your business grow. That's UPWORK.com. Upwork.com.
Yesterday was International Cat Day, and you can bet I tweeted about it because I miss my cats a lot right now. I am traveling. I have been traveling for the last week. I've got some friends looking after my kitties, and I have told them not just to feed them and love them and water them, but to keep an eye on their litter. I don't just mean cleaning the litter, and I know how much everybody who loves cats does not like cleaning the litter. I know it's the worst part of keeping a cat because conventional cat litter is kind of gross. It's pretty much barbaric, but I don't use conventional cat litter and I haven't for a long time. I switched to Pretty Litter a while ago. Pretty Litter is kitty litter 2.0. First of all, it's shipped right to your door in a small lightweight bag that lasts an entire month. No more hauling back huge bags of funky cat litter back from the store. You don't have to store those big heavy bags, you know, with them spilling all over. It's such a mess. And Pretty Litter has next level odor protection. I cannot tell you, I'm highly sensitive to smells. I mean, good smells and bad smells. And believe me, it makes me crazy when I am walking even 15 feet away and I can smell the cat litter. I can't stand it. But I never have to deal with that with Pretty Litter because it has super absorbent crystals that trap and conceal the odor and the moisture. No smell, no mess. Forget about that dirty clay or compost that's so gross to clean up. But the best part about Pretty Litter is that it monitors your cat's health, and that's what I told my friends to keep an eye on. Keep an eye on the color of the litter, because Pretty Litter changes colors to detect underlying illnesses before you need urgent medical care. It saves you money, stress, and potentially your kitty's life. So do what I did and Susan Simpson did and make the switch to Pretty Litter today by visiting prettylitter.com and using the promo code undisclosed for 20% off your first order. That's prettylitter.com, promo code undisclosed for 20% off. prettylitter.com, promo code undisclosed.
The first Conviction Review Unit, or Conviction Integrity Unit, as they're sometimes called, was created by Craig Watkins in Dallas County, soon after he was elected as DA in 2006. Here, Watkins describes the status quo that he felt he had to change upon election.
Before I became DA, and I didn't become DA until 2006, there are about 400 claims of innocence and 400 requests that those DNA cases be looked at. And at the time, the current DA felt that it wasn't necessary to look at those cases, so he denied every one of those individuals who had claimed that they were innocent. Well, I came in, and actually my second day in office, there was an individual that had been waiting for 5 years to be exonerated. And because of the election year and the person that I was running against, he was part of the old administration, they wanted to wait until after the election to allow this person to be exonerated for something he didn't do. Well, unfortunately for my opponent, he lost, and this person was exonerated. And I went downstairs, which the media thought was somewhat unusual, to apologize to the individual for his wrongful conviction for the time that he spent in prison for a crime he didn't commit. And then there was a frenzy. There was a media frenzy after that. They thought, wow, that is somewhat unusual for an elected DA to go down and apologize for the system that failed them.
Nowadays, the idea of a district attorney apologizing to a wrongfully convicted individual isn't as shocking. Indeed, in the case of Chester Holman III that we covered on our podcast, Patricia Cummings from the DA's office and CIU in Philadelphia said, quote, "I apologize to Chester Holman. I apologize because he was failed, and in failing him, we failed the victim, and we failed the community of the city of Philadelphia." After Larry Krasner took office as the DA in Philly, he poached Cummings, who had previously led the Dallas County CRU under Watkins. As Watkins notes, CIUs serve distinct functions from Innocence Projects.
The Innocence Project is a group of individuals that represent folks that claim that they're innocent. Their responsibility is to represent their client. And so our responsibility as prosecutors is somewhat very different than what the Innocence Project does. The Innocence Project, they'll have a client and they have to represent what's in their best interest. As a DA, as a prosecutor, my responsibility is to represent the citizens of Dallas County. And so if a person's innocent or guilty, the Innocence Project will advocate that they're innocent. Their goal is to get their client out of jail. As a DA, my goal is to seek justice, to make sure that if a person is claiming that they're innocent and it is proven to be true that that person's let out of jail, if they also claim that they're innocent and it turns out that they are not, then they stay in jail. And so my role is very different than the Innocence Project. So we created an organization within the DA's office. It's called the Conviction Integrity Unit, whereby we actually proactively look at these claims of innocence.
But Watkins' goal was broader than just proving guilt or innocence in individual cases. Like the Federal Aviation Administration does with plane crashes, he wanted to determine whether wrongful convictions were aberrations or the result of systematic failures in the criminal justice system. Brian Stevenson of the Equal Justice Initiative has given a similar rationale for placing a moratorium on the death penalty.
The other way of thinking about it is not do people deserve to die for the crimes they commit, but do we deserve to kill? I mean, it's fascinating. Death penalty in America is defined by error. For every 9 people who have been executed, we've actually identified 1 innocent person who's been exonerated and released from death row. A kind of astonishing error rate. 1 out of 9 people, innocent. I mean, it's fascinating in aviation. We would never let people fly on airplanes if for every 9 planes that took off, 1 would crash. But somehow we can insulate ourselves from this problem. It's not our problem. It's not our burden. It's not our struggle.
And so, Watkins and his team put in the work and reached a determination that is now commonly accepted. The eyewitness misidentification is the leading cause of wrongful convictions, and that partial remedies exist, such as making eyewitness identifications double blind.
And so we advocated with different police departments throughout Dallas County to change the process in how they did lineups. If any of you have ever taken a class in medicine, you know they do what's called a double blind test. They give you a placebo and then they give you the real drug to make a determination if the real drug is working. But the person that gets the placebo or the real drug, they don't know if they got the real drug. And so we advocated that when we're dealing with lineups, that we go to the double blind system that they use in medicine because it's proven to have worked.
Given that Joseph Webster was convicted based solely on a non-double-blind eyewitness identification by a witness who has since recanted, you might think that this case would be a good candidate for CRU relief. But as Patricia Cummings explains, there are two types of CRUs.
John Hallway, who works at the Quattrone Center, who's actually studied conviction integrity units, has said that there appears to be two types of units throughout the country. Now we're upwards of about 40 of them. And one is the real unit who actually spends the time taking cases and taking cases through a pretty wide funnel. In other words, looking at a lot of cases and then investigating them to figure out if, in fact, something went wrong. That's the real conviction integrity unit. On the other hand, John Hallway refers to what he calls a CRINO. And CRINO stands for Conviction Review in Name Only. Mm-hmm. And that is just the reality of how politically savvy some elected district attorneys have been throughout the country to say, look, we understand as a nation we're talking about wrongful convictions and how actually innocent people get convicted. And so we get it. It's part of our culture now, and we should be doing something about it. And so some district attorneys have said, okay, I'm going to create the unit, but they do it, so to speak, in name only, where there's not really a deep commitment to looking at the cases, investigating them, and actually trying to figure out if, in fact, the system made a mistake and we need to correct something that is a big wrong. I mean, I think we all agree as a society, one of the worst things our criminal justice system can do is convict the innocent.
The numbers back this up. There are 33 conviction review units in the country, but 12 have never exonerated a single person, and 5 have only exonerated one. So which way will the Davidson County Conviction Review Unit go?
Before getting to that, it's now time to note that the CRU has one additional piece of information in the Joseph Webster case. You might recall that Fred McLean said that the killer in this case struck Leroy Owens several times on the head from a cinder block outside a barbecue restaurant. Back in 1998, that cinder block was not tested for DNA, nor was it tested in 2005 when Joseph Webster was arrested, or 2006 when he was prosecuted. It also wasn't tested over the ensuing decade. But then, in 2018, Daniel Horowitz was able to get the National Innocence Project involved. The Innocence Project was able to coordinate DNA testing of the cinder block with Bodie Cellmark Forensics. Samples were obtained from 6 different locations on the cinder block, 2 interior corners of the cinder block and 4 exterior corners, all on the opposite side from the side with Leroy Owens' blood. Here's a Farrier Files discussing the results.
Horowitz's case was so strong, the Innocence Project agreed to test the murder weapon for DNA. The cinder block had never been tested before, and maybe, just maybe, there was the DNA of the killer on the brick. A $26,000 test at one of the country's premier labs showed DNA.
Fortunately, there was a match. We tested multiple places on that block where it would have been handled by the person who was using it to kill the victim. Each one of the places that we tested resulted in a testable male DNA sample. That sample was tested against Joseph Webster, who provided a cheek swab, and he is excluded as a contributor.
I spoke with Gary Harmer, the chief forensic serologist at the Serological Research Institute, about the testing done in this case. And so what's the type of DNA testing they did in this case?
These are short tandem repeats, or STRs, and they're autosomal, which autosomal means that for each, there's only one spot on the DNA in the human genome that contains that marker. So there's one location on each, you know, each person has two pairs of chromosomes. So, for example, if you look at the table 1, you'll see locus, that's the location, mm-hmm. The D3S1358 marker, that's on the regular chromosome, that's called that D, and then a regular chromosome, then it's on the third chromosome, that's what the 3 is, and then number 3 chromosome, and S means somatic, which means it only occurs once in that one location on that chromosome, but, of course, everybody has 2 number 3 chromosomes. So S means somatic, it only occurs once. And 1358 is just the number and order of discovery that they give it. So that's the handle for that particular location on the DNA. So the evidence is 15,16. So one of the chromosomes is type 15. 15 has 15 repeats, and the other one has 16 repeats. So that's how your types arrived at.
As Harmer says, the DNA profile from the six different locations on the cinder block that were swabbed all had the same markers at various chromosome points, and they were consistent on every point. Conversely, the sample from Joseph Webster showed that his DNA profile was not consistent with the markers that were tested and recovered from the cinder block. So, what does that all mean?
With the D3 marker, for example, the evidence is 15-16. And Joseph Webster's a 16-17, so that eliminates him right there, that one marker.
Right. And when you say eliminate, that's to what degree of certainty?
100%.
100%, okay.
For the types that were detected. Now, it may be that his DNA is there and it just didn't get detected, but we can only go over what we see. And that's why we have these limits. That's why you see a lot of these numbers with a dash, dash, dash after it.
Right.
It's because the analyst isn't sure whether they missed or, you know, whether the person's 28-28, for example, or whether they are 28-something else.
Of course, this takes us to the question of whether the murderer in this case likely would have left behind DNA evidence on the cinder block that he used to kill Leroy Owens.
So in this case, you know, it's not the suspect, and if he handled the cinder block, you'd kind of expect to see some of his DNA in there because it's a very rough surface, unless he was wearing gloves.
Okay, and when you say it's likely he would have left DNA because there's a rough surface, can you explain that a little bit?
Sure. If you're brought up against stucco in a house or a brick, it's rough enough, like sandpaper or more coarser, to actually pull some skin cells off. And scrape your hands or fingers. Even if it's just skin, there's still some DNA in that skin, on the surface of the skin as well as in the skin itself. The dermal layer is dead, and there's not much in that, but on the outside, you touch your eye and your mouth and your ear and scratch your head, and you get DNA all over your hands all day long. Depending on how much you wash, you could have a lot of DNA in your hands, which are transferred to the cinder block. Hitting somebody in the head with a cinder block, it's heavy, number one.
Mm-hmm.
And number two, you've got to, you know, do it several times, probably. And it would slip, and then that scraping would remove sample from your hand.
This takes us back to the significance of the new witness, Richard Henderson, that we previewed at the end of episode two. When Tammy Nelson testified at trial, she claimed that one of the perpetrators was wearing gloves when he struck Leroy Owens with a stick. So if she's correct about that, and if the perpetrator was still wearing gloves when he struck Owens with the cinder block, there likely wouldn't be DNA transfer. But remember what an eyewitness to the murder, Richard Henderson, said when he was recently contacted by a private investigator? He said that neither of the perpetrators was wearing gloves. This makes it very likely that the killer would have left DNA evidence behind in the cinder block, and the absence of Joseph Webster's DNA is highly exculpatory. But would the Davidson County Conviction Review Unit view it the same way? Or would they view it the same way they had Tammy Nelson's recantations, the evidence of Kenny Neal's guilt, and eyewitness Anthony Boyce's new statement that the killer was at least 6 feet tall and with a skinny build? When we first started looking at this case, this was an open question, with the CRU still considering it. But the CRU hadn't gotten off to a great start. Here's the beginning of a piece by WPLN.
The Nashville District Attorney's Office has a special unit with a noble goal: to reopen old cases, figure out if someone was wrongfully convicted, and get innocent people out of prison. But 2 years into its creation, the Conviction Review Unit has yet to reopen a case.
And when WPLN says that the CRU had yet to reopen a case, they're not just talking about the lack of an exoneration. Instead, as of January 2019, the CRU had yet to even reopen a case to determine whether or not there should be an exoneration. In other words, the Davidson County CRU was in serious danger of becoming a conviction review unit in name only. And the Joseph Webster case would have been Exhibit A.
That's because the CRU decided not to reopen his case. Unlike the courts, it found that Tammy Nelson's recantations were unreliable. While Anthony Boyce said the killer was at least 6 feet tall with a thin build, the CRU concluded that he did not, quote,
provide any information that leads the CRU panel to conclude that anyone other than Mr. Webster committed the offense.
But what about the family members who said Kenny Neal confessed to the crime? The CRU found that this was already litigated by the courts. What about Shawana Norman, who said Kenny Neal parked his white station wagon at her place and confessed to the crime, likely on the same day of the murder? According to the CRU, this, quote,
witness offered opinions and innuendo. She did not provide any information that leads the CRU panel to a conclusion that anyone other than Mr. Webster committed the offense.
And then, finally, we have the DNA. Here is the CRU's holding.
DNA. Mr. Webster requested DNA testing, and CRU helped to facilitate the testing. On completion, this testing did not lead to other suspects.
And that was it. Case closed. No maybes about it. This was a bad result with no seeming remedy. But Joseph Webster's attorney, Daniel Horowitz, did not take this result sitting down. He followed up with the CRU, noted the significance of the new evidence, pointed out their ability to interview new witnesses such as Lakita Smith, who claimed to be with Tammy Nelson when the perpetrators attacked Leroy Owens. And he railed against the, quote, too many cooks in the kitchen procedure of having seven prosecutors decide whether to reopen a case. Finally, on January 25th of this year, the Webster case caused the CRU to change things up. Here's Julieta Martinelli reporting for WPLN.
Still, the original denial of Webster's application led to some soul searching.
This is the first one that we've got to this point. So it brought to light changes that we thought needed to be made.
That's Robert Jones, who leads the conviction review unit. After months of inquiries from WPLN regarding the board's decision to deny Webster's petition, he says the DA is scrapping the original seven-person unit, calling it unnecessarily cumbersome. As of today, only Jones will decide if a case is recommended for reinvestigation. The final decision still rests with District Attorney Glenn Funk.
I recently got to speak with Robert Jones, who is not able to go on the record about the Joseph Webster case. But he was able to tell me that they had consulted the Quattrone Center report that was referenced earlier in reformulating their CRU. He also said they had spoken to Patricia Cummings at the Philadelphia CIU, who was able to inform him of undisclosed work with them and give advice about how to operate their CRU. Of course, Davidson County reformulating its CRU did not automatically mean they would reopen Joseph Webster's case. But on February 8th, they did just that.
For the first time ever, the Davidson County Prosecutor's Office is looking into a potential wrongful conviction. Late Friday, a conviction review unit announced it would take another look at the case of Joseph Webster, a Nashville man serving a life sentence for murder. WPLN contributor Julieta Martinelli reports on what's next.
Now that Joseph Webster's case has cleared the first hurdle, the DA's office will assign an investigator to track down leads, interview witnesses, and follow up on the new evidence provided by Webster's legal team.
We've been waiting for this for about 2.5 years, and just to get here, he's been extremely patient, always remained optimistic that we would get a fair shake on this one.
Attorney Daniel Horowitz says it's unclear how long the investigation will take, but says he and his client, who has already spent 13 years behind bars, don't want it to be rushed.
This is a case where every single new lead that we've followed up on has revealed more and more and more exculpatory evidence. Everything that gets investigated will be good for him.
Horowitz says it was Webster's brother who committed the crime more than 20 years ago. Once the new investigation is complete, District Attorney Glenn Funk and his top deputies will review the findings. In the end, it will be up to Funk alone to decide on recommending Webster to be freed.
And so, what initially looked like terrible news when the CRU rejected Joseph's case might have ended up leading to a better and fairer CRU that could lead to relief not just for Joseph, but for others in Nashville with plausible innocence claims. Or maybe not. The DNA in the cinder block might end up being a match for Leroy Owens, Kenny Neal, Philip Cotton, or someone with no known connection to the case, all of which could produce different results. And Lakita Smith could end up exonerating Joseph Webster or muddying the waters even more. In either event, we should have an answer soon. When I spoke with Robert Jones recently, he said there should be a decision in Joseph's case in the next couple of months. And when there is, he'll be able to go on the record about the decision, which we'll cover on the podcast. In the meantime, Joseph Webster remains in prison, where he's been for the past 14 years, waiting to hear whether it would be good news or bad news. But in either event, the result will be the same for him. He will never give up.
And what would it mean for you if you were to be released from prison?
That would mean the day. That's the day that I'm waiting on. I'm waiting on that day. I've been waiting on this day since I went to trial. Because I'm innocent. It would mean the world. No, I done lost family members. I miss my time out of my kids' life. They're grown now. I miss them playing football. I miss them all during their school years. I miss my mom. She's getting sick. I miss just everything, man. You know, it's like being in prison, every day you wake up and you're in prison for something you didn't do, it's like one day seems like it's 20 days. So it ain't been just a easy road. It's been very tough. And then when people deny you of your courts, it makes it even worse and puts frustration in. You know, man, it's just a lot to deal with. It's a lot to deal with. But I know that I'm innocent, so I'm not going to stop dealing with it until I'm released.
I know it's a tough question after you've been in prison for so many years, but what would you want to do when you get out?
I would want to be a motivated speaker. Mm-hmm. And tell people my story and let them know that the choices you make in life can affect your life. I just want to give back. I want to give back to my family and my kids, because they've been there with me the most. And I just want to speak on it. I want the world to know and understand that, man, you can never give up when you know you're in the right. Never give up.
A big thank you to everybody who makes Undisclosed possible. Thank you to our sponsors who help us put on our episodes week after week. Thank you to Mital Delahan, our executive producer, for helping keep this ship afloat. Thank you to Rebecca Lavoie, our fantastic audio producer, and also the co-host and producer of a couple of my favorite podcasts, including Crime Writers On. Do not miss her podcast. Thank you to Baluki for our logo, to Christy for maintaining our website. Also, a big thank you to our listeners. Thanks for coming back week after week. Check us out and make sure to follow us online on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Our handle is @UndisclosedPod. And please do not forget to subscribe to us on iTunes and rate us. Thanks so much. See you in a week.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall.
No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong. The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall.
No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.